Go ahead and be seated. Okay, the last matter on our calendar today is docket number 67718, St. Mary v. Damon. Mr. Nold, are you ready to proceed? Okay, come on up. And I understand, are you intending to reserve any time?
Yes, please, Your Honor. Any remaining time for rebuttal.
How much?
5 minutes should be sufficient.
All right, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, my name is Joseph Nold. I have been the attorney of record for St. Mary since approximately 2008. I was their attorney of record through the first appeal. I've been in virtually every hearing and every trial. I realize that my knowledge may be more than the record, so I'm really going to try to control myself because I'm very familiar with this case. There's three real issues before this court today. St. Mary's request for attorney fees, St. Mary's request for cost, and Ms. Damon's motion for a new trial, which was appealed, whether that's just that part or the actual trial itself, that's for the court to decide. I believe that's been briefed. Let's begin with attorney fees. Ms. St. Mary originally filed her motion for attorney fees. The trial court judge said, you're prevailing party, you're entitled to attorney fees. It was electronically served, we got no response. The court then approximately 2 months later held a status check, ordered additional briefing. At that time, St. Mary put forth additional reasons for attorney fees on appeal. She got kind of creative, to be honest with you, about a fee-shifting statute. The opposition failed to oppose any cost and addressed attorney fees. The Honorable Judge Hardcastle, I believe it was him, because it's kind of an odd one on this one, because the stationery is from Judge Regina Hughes, but it appears to be signed by the senior judge, Gerald Hardcastle. So I'm not sure actually whose order that is. But St. Mary's position is it's not the trial court. Now, there's a couple cases that are relevant for this. I'll begin with the standard set forth in Idaho Reserves versus Freeport, which is 110 Nevada 459. It states that it was error for the district court to raise an estoppel issue that was not either pleaded or litigated by the parties. The order denying attorney fees, my words, sua sponte, or brought up the fact that there was a disparity in income and that was not properly addressed. Had that been brought up by Ms. Damon, we would of course said, hold on, there's a requirement you update your financial disclosure form. Ms. Damon has a master's degree and she has her own business. Those facts came out at trial. We didn't address that. But let's move on. There is another reason why that was error. In essence, Judge Hardcastle, and I believe it was Judge Hardcastle because it's his signature, overruled Judge Elliott. I'm going to quote from Masonry and Tile Contractors versus Jolly Erga, 113 Nevada, 737. A district court may reconsider a previously decided issue if substantially different evidence is subsequently introduced or if the decision is clearly erroneous. This is commonly referred to as the law of the case doctrine. And that is defined as, the law of the case doctrine refers to a family of rules embodying the general concept that a court involved in a later phases of a lawsuit so should not reopen questions decided, i.e. established as the law of the case, by that court or a higher one in earlier phases. Judge Elliott says you get attorney fees and cost. Judge Hardcastle says, no, you don't. Our position, and by the way, I'm sorry, Your Honors, the site on that was Reconstruction Trust, N.A. versus Sang, 317 P3D 814, Nevada 2014. Again, our position on that is, Judge Elliott says, you get them, the question is not if, it's how much. a reasonable amount. Whether they're for the appeal or not, there should have been something there. We believe that was reversible error because, in essence...
So what's the basis for Judge Elliott's order approving attorney's fees in this case?
We have the paternity statute, Your Honor. First of all, the court has discretion on awarding attorney fees and costs, and I believe that is 126.071.
So that's the basis on which fees in this case should be awarded. That's your position.
And the second one, very briefly, Your Honor, was 180102B.
Now, Judge Elliott never cited the paternity statute. He said, you're the prevailing party.
Yes.
So I'm trying to understand what in the prevailing party rule provides a basis for an award of attorney's fees.
Well, under 180102B, of course, if it's a frivolous defense. And that's kind of the other part of the argument here, Your Honor.
So under our jurisprudence, under that statute, aren't there required findings by the court that shows that the defense was frivolous? And were such findings ever made, even orally, by Judge Elliott?
No. To answer that question flat out.
So what's the basis for award of attorney's fees by Judge Elliott? Nothing in the record supports that statement. No findings were made. He didn't refer to the paternity statute.
And, Your Honor, that's a difficult question for me. I'm just being honest. That's a difficult question for me to answer. I didn't look at it that way. As far as the paternity statute,
but
yes.
Forget, but your but argument did, is that yes, Judge Hardcastle shouldn't have done what he did because he's bound by what the other judge did, unless clearly erroneous. And I might add there's rules of civil procedure that allow the district court judge, even the original one, to change it at any time if he made or she made a mistake and wishes to correct it before the final judgment's entered.
Yes, Your Honor.
So wasn't that the case here? Wasn't this clearly erroneous in the absence of a reference to the statute or a determination that this was a frivolous defense under 2B of 18110?
Well, on that one, Your Honor, I believe the judge's findings and the over, there is no specific finding, to answer your question, by Judge Elliott during the trial that it was frivolous. But I believe when he went through the laundry list, which I'll cite to that in a few moments, of all of the empirical facts that show that St. Mary was a parent, that the entire time period here, the statement by Ms. Damon has been, you're just a surrogate, you're just a surrogate, you're just a surrogate. And then Judge Elliott went through what he called the laundry list.
Well, for purposes of a frivolous defense basis for fees, that's a lot different. I mean, there was a lot of testimony here from various people on Ms. Damon's side of the case that St. Mary acted as a surrogate. I recognize that there's a difference of view about the facts, but it wasn't as if there wasn't some information provided to support that defense.
Yes, Your Honor, as far as that would go to absolutely the credibility of the witness.
Right.
And Judge Elliott rejected those statements.
But that doesn't, for purposes of making the determination about the custody award and the parenting relationship, but not for purposes of establishing fees. I mean, at a minimum, let's take Judge Hardcastle's position. He rejected this. He didn't even explain why. Did he?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
So neither district judge really offered much help to anybody in this case as to why fees would be ordered on the one hand or rejected on the other.
Yes. The last thing I would say, because I'm running out of time, Your Honor, the last thing I would say is when Judge Elliott said you're the prevailing party, you're entitled to attorney fees, I would respectfully assert to the court that that's unnecessarily restricting him to not use the paternity statute, because the paternity statute allows for an award after viewing what's going on.
Let me ask you this then. Even sure. Using the paternity statute and accepting your argument, what factors did he use in determining the reasonableness of the fees?
Well, we cited the Brunzell factors in there.
No. What did the judges themselves, Judge Elliott, point to determine the reasonableness?
Well, he did not address that at all, Your Honor.
So there are no findings under the Brunzell?
Correct. Well, it was done by a subsequent motion, so those factors were not even presented to Judge Elliott. You're a prevailing party, as this court's aware. Then you file your motion for attorney fees. You put in the Brunzell factors. The court looks at the reasonableness. And if requested or Love v. Love, you supply your billing sheets, is what was done. That actually wasn't requested. The court ordered that I supplied them, and I supplied them. And there was no specific argument by anyone that any of the billing was overbilling, not necessary or otherwise. As far as the reasonableness of the fees, that was not, that was not opposed by Ms. Damon. The reasonableness of them, just the basis for it. Briefly on cost. There was no opposition to award of cost. Judge Hardcastle found the approach novel. All I will say to this court is, had there been any opposition on cost, I would have also pointed to NRS 18.060, which, if the court is silent on it, requires an award of cost. It's mandatory for an appeal. But again, without any opposition on it, with no argument, we weren't afforded an opportunity to even put that forward. It was unopposed. I will save my remaining time for rebuttals, unless the court has any questions.
Colleagues? All right, I guess not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Smith, are you ready? Come on up, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Jordan Smith on behalf of Ms. Damon. Following the first appeal, the en banc court remanded this matter for an evidentiary hearing on two issues. First, whether St. Mary was an intended parent or surrogate, and depending upon the outcome of that question, the issue of visitation and custody. The district court committed reversible error on both of those issues. But before discussing the specific assignment of errors, I do need to briefly address this morning the order that's before this court and the arguments that are before this court. Before the appointment of pro bono counsel, Ms. Damon filed her notice of appeal while proceeding pro se. That notice of appeal only references the March 2nd, 2015 order denying the motion for new trial. However, in context of the record as a whole, it's clear that Ms. Damon manifested an intent to appeal the underlying judgment as well.
I think those issues are covered in the briefs. I suggest you use your time on the other material issues. And let me point out to you, you did offer a cross appeal and a reply, and you are entitled to rebuttal time if you like it.
I'll save 1 minute on the attorney's fees and costs issue.
Okay.
But other than that, I'll use my time.
Very good.
I appreciate Justice Hardis, your comment on moving on. There is one point you need to make about preservation, though, that I admit is a little bit unclear from the briefs. And that has to do with the preservation of the presumption argument and the insufficient evidence argument. The briefs are a little bit unclear, and some of that lack of clarity comes from the fact that the motion for new trial was filed before the underlying findings of fact. And so the presumption issue was preserved specifically in the supplemental briefing that was allowed, which was filed in February of 2015. And the record site for the presumption issue and for the insufficient evidence, and specifically lack of pre-implantation intent, that's at ROA 217, and then that's for the presumption issue, and then ROA 217 to 218. So I agree the briefing is a little bit unclear on that, but I need to make sure that those record sites are in the brief for that preservation issue. And so there are five assignments of error alleged here, but I want to focus our limited time this morning on three of those. The first being the wrongful presumption under NRS 126.041, the second being the insufficient evidence of intent for parentage and specifically lack of pre-implantation intent, and then the district court's misapplication of the best interest factors under NRS 125.480. Regarding the wrongful presumption argument, NRS 126.041 is unequivocal and clear. It says the parent-child relationship between a child and a woman may be established by proof of giving birth. May is permissive language, it's not presumptive language, and there's no analog in 126.051 dealing with paternity. There's also an exception in that statute now in the current version for gestational carriers. And the reason for that is obvious. Giving birth is equally consistent with parentage as it is with surrogacy. And that's the entire point of the remand. The entire point of the remand was to determine, notwithstanding the fact that St. Mary gave birth, whether she was an intended parent or not. The district court's order is clear. It says that as a matter of law, St. Mary is presumed to be a parent because she gave birth. That defeated the entire purpose of the remand. The remand, again, was to determine the intent of the parties, notwithstanding the fact that St. Mary gave birth.
I think there was a little more testimony given down below in that regard, wasn't there? other than just the fact that she gave birth?
Well, I think the relevant time period, Your Honors, here is pre-implantation intent. So the court remanded saying, for an evidentiary hearing, the intent of the parties in creating the child. So that's pre-implantation intent. And St. Mary didn't introduce substantial evidence on the pre-implantation intent time frame. Her evidence focused solely on the fact of the party's course of dealing after the child was born. Photographs, envelopes of mail, Thanksgiving was a focus of the evidence. But the pre-implantation intent and what the party's intent...
Well, there was evidence pre-birth.
Pre-birth, Your Honor, but I think pre-implantation...
Well, why wouldn't information, evidence offered pre-birth go to the party's intent or help inform the party's intent pre-implantation?
Let me explain why I think pre-implantation should be the time frame and not after implantation and before birth. To truly understand whether the parties intended to have a surrogacy arrangement, a co-parenting arrangement, or an egg donation arrangement, think of it as contract formation. What did the parties intend going into this? So that parties may change their mind. For instance, a husband and wife may hire a surrogate. If they decide after the egg was implanted they no longer want to do this, the court wouldn't say the child's born without any parents. The court would say, husband and wife, you intended to have a child, but for that intention, the egg wouldn't have been planted and there wouldn't have been a child. So parties change their mind, and that's why I don't think you can focus on after the fact. And that's what the California Supreme Court said in the Johnson versus Calvert case. In Johnson versus Calvert, the court said, in an in vitro situation, when you have a same-sex couple, two women, each coming forward with acceptable but not conclusive evidence of maternity, you look at the party's pre-implantation intent. And pre-implantation intent is, that theme is throughout Chapter 126. If you look, for example, at NRS...
Why wouldn't the execution of the co-parenting agreement be consistent with the pre-implantation intent? Otherwise, I guess we're supposed to conclude that the parties purposefully defrauded the medical insurance company.
Regardless of the insurance issue with the co-parenting agreement, it's not evidence of pre-implantation intent, because it's undisputed that agreement was executed after implantation. The agreement was dated...
Right, but why can't that evidence be introduced to show that it's conduct consistent with the oral agreement? I mean, we don't have any written agreement before implantation, so we're trying to ascertain the party's intent in going into this birth. Why isn't subsequent information, subsequent acts, informative of the intent of the parties before implantation?
This case is a perfect example of why subsequent acts after implantation shouldn't be considered, because parties do change their mind. They went into this agreement with St. Mary's agreeing to be a surrogate, and I'll point to the pre-implantation evidence that there is. Aside from the co-parenting agreement, which was dated after the fact, St. Mary's agree was backdated. That testimony is at App 204 and 205. So that's not before implantation. The medical records, which are before pre-implantation, state that St. Mary presented with the intention to be a gestational carrier for her partner.
Let me ask you this question. You said there was no evidence. But I'm looking, and it seems like there was testimony as they were first discussing having a child together. Ms. Damon indicated that she'd been in previous relationships where she'd bonded with her partner's children and then was not allowed to see the children after the relationship ended. And that's why she insisted that her eggs be used as opposed to St. Mary's, even though the doctor recommended that St. Mary's eggs might be more appropriate to use. Because I guess she was younger.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there was evidence.
I don't think that constitutes the evidence. That statement by Ms. Damon saying the reason she wanted to have her own child, that evidence, she bonded with children previously, she wanted to have her own child and not have to share custody. So that's what that evidence stated. Ms. Damon didn't want to have a partner. She wanted to have a child all her own. So that's the statement about her bonding with other children. That explains, and I think Ms. Damon testified to this, that explains why she wanted to have the child on her own. It's because she didn't want a subsequent breakup like this and have a custody battle. Okay. That was her entire point of wanting to have the child by herself.
Oh, okay.
Then the two witnesses that did focus on the pre-implantation time frame are Ms. Kim McDermott, who testified that in summer of 2007, so before the egg was implanted in October of 2007, she testified to having a conversation with Ms. St. Mary, where St. Mary said, "This is Veronica's child. I'll have my own child later. I'll never try to take the child away." That's at app 316 and 317 of the record. Ms. McDermott also testified that in end of May and early June 2007, that the three of them, Ms. McDermott, Ms. Damon, and Ms. St. Mary, were having a conversation with when Ms. Damon said that Ms. St. Mary was going to be a surrogate, and Ms. St. Mary didn't protest. That's at app 292 and 293 of the record. That's the witness testimony that focuses on the pre-implantation time frame.
So counsel's representation that there was no evidence you disagree with?
The evidence pointed directly to the fact that everybody prior to implantation thought Ms. St. Mary was going to be a surrogate. That was the intention. So that the evidence I've described is the evidence in the record regarding the pre-implantation time frame, and all that evidence points to the fact that Ms. St. Mary was an intended surrogate, not an intended co-parent.
Your first assignment of error is that the judge in his order of, I presume you're referring to Judge Elliott's order of November 25th, did not appropriately apply the presumption in 041, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand where in the order you get that from.
That's on page 5 of the order. I don't have the app record, but if you pull up...
I've got it. It's 1034.
If you look at page 5 of the November 25th order, mm-hmm. that finding is there. I can grab my copy of the record and read it specifically, but it says it's about...
Well, that's what you're relying on, so that you've answered my question. Maybe you could move on to another point.
Okay. So aside from the wrongful presumption and the insufficient evidence of pre-implantation intent, the only other parentage statute that St. Mary can point to is the holding out the child, welcoming the child into her own home and holding the child out as her own. Again, I don't think we get to this provision because, as the California courts demonstrate, the holding out and welcoming to the own home generally only applies when there's not a surrogacy or gestational carrier issue. For example, the Alyssa B. case that was cited in this court's first order had to do with a same-sex couple each carrying their own child. They used the same sperm donor, but each carried their own child. Subsequently, the couple breaks up. The state of California went after one of the former partners for support of the other one's twins under a holding out theory because there was no egg donation, surrogacy question there. Very similarly is the SBSY case that we cite. Same-sex couple, one of which adopted a child, a partner breaks up, and the former partner now wants to have parental rights over the adopted child, and that was under a holding out theory. So generally, the holding out theory applies when there's no surrogacy question or egg donation issue. But if the court were to still look at post-implantation conduct and post-birth conduct, Ms. St. Mary has to demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence that she welcomed the child into her home and held the child out as her own. It's undisputed that this was Ms. Damon's house with her former ex-girlfriend. And I recognize title to a house can't be conclusive. But in cases where a partner is trying to claim the other partner's house as the welcoming into their own house, there's at least specific evidence in the record about how often the partner was there. For example, the SBSY case, there was specific testimony in that case that the partner was there, quote, virtually every night or at least 4 nights out of 7. And the RM versus TA case that we cite, there was specific evidence that the girlfriend was in Louisiana for weeks at a time, months at a time. There's not that type of evidence, let alone substantial evidence, on that point here. And finally, you have to look at the unequivocal nature of the breadth and scope of holding the child out on their own. That's what the California courts say, unequivocal nature of breadth and scope. Here the district court said the evidence essentially balances out. Well, the evidence essentially balances out, that doesn't equate to unequivocal nature of breadth and scope. Ms. St. Mary pointed to photographs, but no evidence that they were circulated widely to the community. In those cases where they did find holding out, generally there are big open ceremonies. I forget the case, but one of them has a military medal ceremony where only family could pin the medal onto the family member, and that was used as evidence of holding out as their own. Here, Both parties presented the equal number of witnesses, and again, the district court said that the evidence essentially balanced out. And I'll briefly, with my 1 minute remaining, I'll discuss the misapplication of the NRS 125.480 factors. The district court here really entered an astonishing custody order that required Ms. Damon and the child to move back to Las Vegas on 48 hours notice, and the district court did so with little to no explanation. He addressed only three of the NRS 125.480 factors, discounting the evidence of the court-appointed representative that this court said in a footnote in the first decision should probably be appointed for Shelby. That court-appointed representative said, based upon his observations, that Shelby was thriving in Washington, was a fantastic little girl, lots of activities, seemed to be doing extremely, extremely well. His own testimony was, based upon his interactions and observations with Shelby, that unfettered in-person visitation in Las Vegas would have a substantial, harmful emotional impact on Shelby. The district court disregarded that testimony, and sua sponte considered the school calendar. I find it interesting that my colleague faults the district court for sua sponte considering things for the motion on attorney's fees, but doesn't fault the district court for sua sponte considering the school calendar that had no argument or evidence presented to it and required this family to move back to Las Vegas in 48 hours. I'll reserve the last 30 seconds of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Excuse me. I would like to begin with the presumption. A review of the record shows that nowhere did the court say that there was a presumption during the trial of this matter. Nowhere did he say there was a shifting of the burden or anything like that. I drafted the order. We know that as a matter of law or as a matter of fact, because in the upper left-hand corner is my name.
So let me ask you this. As it relates to the best interest of the child, there's a whole bunch of factors listed, but counsel indicated none of these factors were discussed or, in fact, implicated in the hearing other than two.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so here's where did that come from?
Here's my point with the order. When you're drafting an order as an attorney, you put in certain things. You try to get the other side to sign off on it. I put in about the presumption that she was the mother by giving birth.
Yeah, I know. I've got it all right here. So,
yep. And the same thing I put in, the court considered all factors.
You then, you know?
I just put that in the order, Your Honor. The court, what he said was, I don't have all of the factors in front of me right now. He didn't articulate any specific findings on any of them. We run under the presumption that the court made the proper decision and considered all the factors because it was briefed. We did a 7 EDCR 7.27 brief. There were pretrial memorandums. The factors, which are now recodified, NRS 480, were all briefed for the judge. And then when he was
Mr. Nold, is there an internal inconsistency in your order of November 25th, or the court's order, one you drafted for the judge? On page 4, line 15 and 16, it recites, the court concludes as a matter of law that one way of proving parentage is a woman having given birth to the minor child. Yet on page 5, line 13 through 14, the order recites, the court further concludes as a matter of law that plaintiff was the birth mother of the child and presumed to be a parent. Is that statement inconsistent with the provisions of 126.041 sub 1?
Yes, Your Honor. I put that in there. That was a mistake. That's the only way I can put it to this court. When I'm drafting an order.
So what is your response to counsel's assignment of error that the district court judge appears to have applied the wrong presumption under 126.041?
Because that was something that I put in the order. That's what I originally started with, Your Honor. It's never addressed in the record. The Judge Elliott never said, here's the presumption, this is the burden, this is the shifting of burden. I would say it would be harmless error, is what I briefed for this court. Harmless error for myself, and I didn't say it like that, I should have, to include that in there.
You're arguing that he didn't really apply the presumption notwithstanding the statement in your incorrect order.
That would be a fair...
He instead looked at the evidence and made a separate independent determination of parentage.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And let's look at
the evidence presented.
Yeah, let's look at exactly what we're talking about. Yeah. And that is on the record on appeal, APP. It begins with 0501. Mm-hmm. This was when the court was talking about the findings. I'd like to start off very briefly with this balancing. Here's what Judge Elliott said. Well, you know, it's hard to say, you know, who's right, who's wrong. But I tend to think, you know, when you look at the evidence of the case, the more objective evidence is in the case, it balances out as proof that there was act, that there was actually was the intent. And I think a fact that St. Mary is the child's mother, one of two mothers. We will look at the objective facts. There's just a whole list of them. We look at the birth certificate itself. The 2009 order, as noted by the Supreme Court, did not take away Miss St. Mary as the mother. It simply indicated that there were two mothers. When you look at then the co-parenting agreement signed, I believe, on October 5th, 2007. Miss Damon says that it's a fraudulent document, done only, you know, for the purposes of insurance fraud. But it's signed by the parties, you know, it's a clear statement of both of them, you know, that they're being a parent of the child. And actually, you know, starts out with Veronica being the biological parent and Miss Damon being the non-biological parent. This portion of the record is where the court made the findings. And just before that, when he talked about the balancing out, he talked about the equal number of witnesses on both sides. It was clear from this portion of his finding that he disregarded the testimony.
So I have a separate question, which gets to the judge's decision about custody of the child. Would you agree that the order of November 25th fails to comply with this court's dictates in Davis versus Awolefo?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't know in what way it fails to comply with it.
That court, this court in 2015, said that in determining the statutory best interest of the child factors enumerated in 125.484, the court must make specific findings and an adequate explanation of the reasons for the custody determination. And they are crucial to enforce or modify a custody order for appellate review. Without them, this court cannot say with assurance that the legal custody determination was made for appropriate legal reasons.
Yes, it is insufficient. I can't say anything other than that, Your Honor. But I would believe that the transcript gives all of the proper reasonings on the finding of...
You're aware that we can't operate on the transcript.
I understand, Your Honor. But again, I'm being honest, I can't say anything other than that. It is insufficient. It does not comply with that decision, Your Honor.
Okay. And was there anything in the judge's new trial order or order with respect to the new trial request that remedied that?
No, Your Honor, that was, but I would also point out that that objection was never made in the motion for a new trial.
Right.
Most of what were before you was not made. There was no objection on it.
Okay.
I'm out of time. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. And I think you reserved a minute.
On that last point on the preservation for the best interest, what counsel forgetting that was made in the motion for new trial, specifically at page 1051, at App 1051, that's where the lack of findings under the parentage was specifically made. Also, what you didn't hear counsel describe for you when he's going through his supposed laundry list of evidence was any pre-implantation. He pointed to the birth certificate after implantation. He pointed to course of dealing. You didn't hear him mention any evidence, let alone substantial evidence in the record, about pre-implantation intent. And again, I want to focus on why I think that's important. The NRS Chapter 126 has that notion of pre-implantation intent, especially the new gestational carrier provisions. I'd point the court to NRS 126.780, which says that there's a dispute about a gestational carrier agreement that has to be resolved on the original intent of the parties. That phrase, original intent, is in the statute, and that shows original intent entering into the agreement with that notion of pre-implantation intent. I thank the court for its time.
Counsel, thank you both. We appreciate the briefing in this case, and your arguments were well presented, so...